This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. The U.S. provides financial support to Israel, and the U.S. and Israel are widely said to have a special relationship. But what does the U.S. get out of that relationship? And is it time for the U.S. to rethink its commitments to Israel? Cato's John Hoffman comments. How would you characterize the relationship, either militarily or socially or culturally, between the United States and Israel since, you know, the mid-1950s?
Sure. So I would characterize it the way that President Kennedy characterized it. It is a quote-unquote special relationship. It is truly unique in its manifestation. And really what I mean by this is diplomatically, politically, militarily, this relationship is not akin to America's relationship with really any other country on earth, you know, and at the heart of this special relationship is really the unparalleled amount of aid that the United States provides to Israel, $300 billion adjusted for inflation since World War II, continued at $3.8 billion annually. So, you know, I try to situate this within the broader context of U.S. Middle East policy and just showing that the U.S.-Israel relationship is not only exceptional in terms of America's approach to the Middle East, but almost, you know, it's exceptional in terms of America's engagement with relations writ large across the world.
When people who are, especially in Congress, big supporters of Israel and are defending the United States, writing those big checks every year, they talk about, look, this is a democracy in the Middle East. It is a critical ally. It is in the vital national security interests, not to be confused with merely being in national security interests of the United States. So either what are they misunderstanding, or how much credence do you give that notion that the U.S. and Israel relationship is vital?
Sure. So, you know, I kind of take a step back and look at this from 50,000 feet and say, you know, okay, if it is vital to the national interests of the United States, first, what are those interests? Second, how does this relationship, which I characterize in the article here as uneven, how does it advance those interests? So when I look at it, I say American interests, whether it be in the Middle East or anywhere, is the safety and the prosperity of the American people while also upholding the values that we as a nation claim to stand for. I don't see how the U.S. relationship with Israel as currently configured advances those interests. So that's what I try to push back on and try to bring this back to a debate regarding first order assumptions, saying, well, guys, what are our interests? How does the U.S.-Israel relationship in its current configuration advance those interests? And if we find that it doesn't, then how could the United States change course moving forward?
So what does the U.S. get for its, as you said, $3.8 billion that the U.S. provides to Israel in aid?
I think, you know, the number one thing that people typically point to is intelligence sharing between Israel and the United States. Lindsey Graham has referred to Israel as America's eyes and ears in the Middle East. But, you know, I, again, take a step back and question whether $3.8 billion a year, unwavering support for whatever Israel's policies are, even when they're directly affront to the United States, whether that these overtures are necessary in order for Israel to share, you know, intelligence with the United States, for example. You know, it's in Israel's vested interest to share intelligence with the United States regarding threats that it faces in the region. So, you know, I argue in the piece here that the give and take of the U.S.-Israel relationship is a vast majority of give and not a whole lot of take here.
So how do we square, or how do foreign policy elites in Washington square the U.S. relationship with Israel and the U.S. relationship with, say, Saudi Arabia and the UAE? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for the United States to be providing, if not billions of dollars, military hardware, logistical support, and that sort of putting a soft rubber stamp on the actions of those governments.
No, absolutely. And I think this point that you just raised is critical. Whether it be Israel, whether it be Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, any of these governments in the Middle East that the United States heavily subsidizes, floods them with weapons, so on and so forth, we need to take a step back and ask, has our overly militarized approach to the region produced stability? Has it produced security? Or has it produced insecurity and instability? And, you know, when we look at the Middle East and when we look at U.S. interests in the Middle East, I and, you know, my colleagues here at Cato argue these interests are very limited. They're very easy to achieve. They don't require this outsized, you know, U.S. presence and this outsized role that the Middle East plays in the U.S. foreign policy community in here in D.C. And I argue that the Middle East should be approached the way any region on Earth should be approached, and that's from a perspective of concrete U.S. interests.
We have talked about this in a different context, which is the normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and why the United States needs to write additional checks in order to get these two countries to follow what seem to be fairly aligned interests, and why the U.S. needs to be brokering this deal between these two countries that the U.S. is already financially supporting. And, you know, both of these countries are involved in what I would say are fairly objectionable or at least strongly debatable actions to their neighbors. So with specific respect then to Israel, what, again, I'll ask, what does the U.S. get in terms of security that we can hang our hat on and say this is worth the $3 or $4 billion.
No, and that's the question that I'm raising here, because I would argue that the United States gets virtually nothing from these relationships. And in respect to these normalization agreements, you know, there has been this just fixation, almost obsession within the Biden administration to broker Saudi-Israel normalization as if this is going to solve every single problem in the Middle East, cure world hunger, you know, the list goes on. You know, they think this moonshot is just going to solve everything. And I've written a lot about how, one, that's just false. But two, this fixation on brokering Israel-Saudi normalization obscures the underlying roots of insecurity and instability within the Middle East and what the United States is offering in return, namely the unprecedented concession of a security guarantee to Saudi Arabia in cooperation on its civilian nuclear program. These would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. It would formally cement legally our commitment to these underlying sources of instability. And this will have ramifications for generations to come. And what's really mind-blowing is the past 7 or 6 months, you know, of war, you know, ongoing in Gaza should have, you know, really shown the United States that these normalization agreements haven't produced the peace and security and stability that, you know, its proponents so wholeheartedly claim. But instead, what we see is Biden's Middle East strategy on October 6th is the same as his strategy on October 7th, as it is on October 8th, all the way up till now. So they remain rooted in this preconceived notion that Saudi-Israel normalization will save everyone.
A lot of terrible things around the world happen, and the United States has to make calculations about how those events affect U.S. security. The United States has made a particular decision with regard to Ukraine, for example. The United States continues to financially support Israel and a lot of officials within the government supporting Israel with respect to its war with Hamas. The United States seems quite a bit quieter about Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, but the financial support continues to flow. So how does the U.S. make decisions, and how much do you think it's appropriate for the U.S. in a sense to own the consequences of our financial support to the extent that it is actually feeding wars that many Americans find highly objectionable?
Yeah, so I think, you know, and it's great that you're bringing all of these different conflict areas and situations together, because what should be stressed here is that the United States often finds itself so deeply involved in these conflicts, and by subsidizing a particular side, by subsidizing the policies of whatever actor they end up supporting. And all of this money, all of this aid, in theory, should come with leverage, right? Like the one writing the check should, you know, kind of have a say in what's happening. And, you know, the past 6 months, particularly in Gaza, we see it's just so explicit and such, you know, on display. You know, you see Biden, you know, I call him strategically leaked news about Biden being frustrated with Netanyahu, with Biden, you know, clamoring against, you know, a possible ground invasion of Rafah. You know, he put forth his ethereal red line, so on and so forth. But Biden is acting as if, you know, he's somebody who's upset and wants to see a manager. He's the one writing the checks here. So U.S. involvement, when it just amounts to 100% deference to the interests of the actor that is receiving the checks, we lose sight of what are American interests and what are the interests of the actor, you know, be it Israel, Ukraine, Saudi Arabia, that we're effectively subsidizing here. And more often than not, we will find that there is a disconnect in interests, but we often see a reluctance on the behalf of Washington to use this leverage that it claims this aid is supposed to provide it. And we see a more general resorting to just muscle memory and this reflexive resorting to throwing money, weapons, and military hardware at the problem and saying, you know, kind of washing our hands of it and saying, well, it'll fix itself.
John Hoffman is a foreign policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please. And thank you for listening.